So Psalm 139 is one of my favorite psalms, and it's one of the great psalms of David. But if we're going to appreciate David's heart in this, you have to understand that when David thinks about the love of God, he feels like he won the lottery. Like he hit the jackpot. Like when he thinks about this fact, he considers the fact that God loves him of all people. He feels like he is the luckiest guy in the world. So let me put this into like a grade school context, because we've all been there. This is that moment when you're like fifth grade, fourth grade, third grade, somewhere in there, and there's that one cute or, you know, boy or girl who you kind of have your eye on. And so during recess, you get a note and you write, "Do you like me? Check yes, no, or maybe." And then you take it over there, and maybe you send a friend over there, you know, hand it off to them. And then later on, one of their friends comes back and you open it up and they have checked the yes box. And you're like, yes, Cindy Lou liked this guy, right? I mean, you're on cloud nine. Now, you're trying to play it cool outside, right? But on the inside, you look more like this guy. You're like, yeah, that's what's up, right? You are on cloud nine. You are walking on air. It's that moment when there's that guy or that girl that you've had your eye on. They're so great. And you ask them out and they actually say yes. Or for those of you who are married, it's when your spouse asked you to marry them, or you asked them to marry you and they said yes, or you said yes, and you can't begin to believe just how lucky you could be. That this guy, this girl who you think is so great, so amazing, so wonderful, would actually love you of all people. And you can hardly begin to wrap your head around it. Like it just blows you away. You can't even begin to grasp how that person could love you. Pinch me, I might be dreaming. See, that's how David feels when he thinks about the love of God. When he thinks about the love of God, who created the universe, loves him, that blows his mind. He can't even begin to wrap his head around it. That's why in verse 6, he says, "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's high, I cannot attain it." In other words, it's too much for me to grasp. I can't even believe it's true. Pinch me, I might be dreaming. And so in Psalm 139, David is inviting us to join him in basking and reveling in this reality that God, the God of the universe, actually loves us. Now, here's the rub. And here's why David, when he considers the love of God, feels like he won the lottery, why he dances around the room, and while many of us yawn. And here's why. It's because, however you are amazed and appreciate God, that's the level at which you will appreciate and be amazed by his love. Okay, so our amazement and appreciation for God is going to determine just how greatly we are amazed and appreciate God's love. How much you love and appreciate God determines how you'll appreciate and wonder at his love for you. In other words, if you are amazed by who God is, by his beauty, his character, his person, then you will be equally amazed by the fact that he loves you. But if you're not really all that impressed with God, you know, he's just kind of there. You're sort of indifferent. If you take God for granted, then you're not going to care that God loves you. In fact, God's love will actually be too much for you. God's love will feel overbearing. It will feel burdensome. You'll feel cramped in. It will make you uncomfortable. It will even make you cringe. It all depends on how you view and value God. So let's look at the first few verses. I'm going to show you what I mean. Okay, so let's start with verse 1. "So, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all together." So what David's saying here is that God knows you better than you know you. God knows you better than you know you. There's no secrets that you're keeping from God. There's no skeletons in your closet that God doesn't know about. God knows every mistake, every failure, every regret, every hurt. But he also knows every victory, every dream, every hope, every fear, every love in your life. He knows what you're thinking before you think it. He knows the words that you're going to say before you say them. God knows you better than you know you. Now, when I read these verses, here's what I think. Here's what comes to my mind. Every move you make, every bond you break. I don't actually know the words. Every smile you fake, every claim you stake, I'll be watching. You just kind of rhyme through that. But you know what I'm saying, right? Now, check this out. That song, you guys all remember that song. That song can either be romantic or creepy, depending on who's singing it, correct? It depends on who's singing that song. Okay, so ladies, if that's your beau who's singing that to you, that's your guy, he's singing that to you, you get all fluttery. You're like, oh yeah, my man, he knows me. He knows me better than I know me. He knows my thoughts. He can anticipate my every need and everything that I'm, all my whims, right? That's a good thing. You want someone to sing that to you who you care about. You feel valued and cared in that. Now, at the same time, if it's the creepy guy at the supermarket who kind of watching you, like, that's not cool. You don't want that guy singing that song to you. That's just creepy and weird. You are uncomfortable at that point. But see, it depends on who's singing to you. And so if we are in awe of who God is, if we are like, oh man, God is so great, he is so amazing, then we want him to sing that to you. But if you aren't in awe of God, then you don't want him to sing to you. In which case you would say, God, you know what? This is a bit intense for me. This is a little bit overkill, don't you think? I mean, look, God, I want you in my life. I want you to keep me safe, give me what I need, come when I call you, give me a happy life. But this is a little bit much. This is a little overbearing, God. You need to take it down a notch, because check this out. I don't need you to know me better than I know me just to do the things that I need you to do. Like if God is basically a servant to you, then you don't need him to anticipate your every need. I mean, you just let him know. God, I need this. Could you take care of that for me? That's fantastic. He's there to serve you. He's at your beck and call. I don't need the person who cleans my house to know my bank statements. That is too intimate. They don't need to know anything like that. So if God is basically a servant to me, then I don't need God to love me like this. This is overkill. Or maybe you read this and you think, well, man, God actually kind of sounds like a big brother type. He's basically an almighty NSA. He's going through your garbage and your mail and your bank statements so that he can catch you having fun and punish you. In which case, you would read this and say, God, man, that is too much. I need some privacy. You need to respect my space. There are areas in my life, God, in which you are not allowed. C.S. Lewis put it well when he said that oftentimes our biggest problem with God is not that he loves us too little, it's that he loves us too much. And we wish he would just take it down a notch. But if you're amazed by God, that he is the all-powerful creator who loved you and made you and created beauty and brings joy and happiness into your life, then you want him to know you like that. You want him to finish your sentences. You want him to know your thoughts. You want him to know your words, the good and the bad. You want him to know you better than you know yourself. Because look, all of us have this innate desire, right, to be known. We want people to know us, or at least the right people to know us. We want them to know everything about us, the good stuff, the bad stuff, everything. We want to be known like that. There's a longing in our heart to be known like that. And David said, God knows you like that. Again, if it's the creepy guy in the supermarket, that's not cool. That's not cool. Guys, if it's that psycho girl who keeps calling you and leaving you voice messages on your voicemail about cats, not cool. Not cool. But if it's that person who you have your eye on, who hung the moon in your mind, they are so wonderful, so fantastic. You can't even begin to believe that they would give you attention. You want them to know you like that. I mean, think about this. Guys, husbands, I'm going to talk to you for just a moment. Does your wife want you to know her better or worse? More or less? Does she want you to be tuned into her every need, or would she rather nag you about it? Yeah, see, obviously she wants you to know her like that, because when you know her better than she knows herself, she feels valued and cared for. And David says, that's how God loves us. Now, here's the thing. Even if you don't like that, even if you see God as an NSA going through your mail, and you're like, ah, I wish he would take it down a notch. God's just a servant to you. Understand, you can't change this. You can't escape God. There's nowhere that you're going to go where you're going to be able to run away from God. You can't get away from God. And this is what David is pointing out here. So if it wasn't bad enough that he knows you better than you know yourself, you can't escape. Look at verse 7. Where shall I go from your spirit? Where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. So, confession time. And I've shared this before, but when my wife Carrie and I first got married, we had like this 450 maybe square foot apartment. And I'm an intense introvert, and not everyone believes that, but I am. Dan Clow, wherever you are, I am an introvert. He keeps arguing with me. So here we are in this 450 square foot apartment, basically two rooms, and I cannot get away. She is always there. And this took a little bit of adjustment for me, but like just let me relive this for a moment. I mean, I would wake up in the morning and she was there. I go to work, I come back, she's there, eat dinner, she's there, sit on the couch, she's there, watch TV, she's there, get ready for bed, go to bed, she's there, wake up in the next morning, starts all over again, she's still there. I eventually got over this. You know how? You know how? True story, you ready for this? I'm slow, but I'm not stupid. And once it dawned on me that I had a beautiful, intelligent, fun-loving, funny, interesting woman who is completely out of my league, okay? Like, I don't deserve her. In Texas, we have a football analogy for everything, so we call this outkicking your coverage. I outkicked my coverage. She is way too good for me. She's out of my league. I don't deserve her. Once I realized that I had a woman like that who loved me enough to spend every waking moment with me, it didn't take a genius to figure out maybe I shouldn't take that for granted, that I'd hit the jackpot. It didn't take me long, right? I'm slow, but I'm not stupid. Can I just have a moment with the guys just for a second? I understand some of you guys, you got a girlfriend, you got a wife, and you wish at times, not all the time, but every now and again, man, they just give you a little bit more space. There was a little bit more breathing room in your relationship. And ladies, some of you are like, what is wrong with our men? What is wrong with them that they would think like that? I'm not talking to you right now. This is a private conversation, me and the guys, okay? Just, I'll get to you, all right? So guys, listen, I get that. I appreciate that. Funny story, I had a buddy. It was like a group of us, like couples, you know? And we were kind of the guys hanging out. And it was like, the things you don't talk about. He was like, yeah, when I get home, I just have to like sit in my car for a few minutes and just kind of like catch my breath before going inside and seeing my wife. And it got really quiet. And it was one of those moments where like all the conversation stopped and we just heard him. It got really awkward. Anyway, she was not happy. All right, but look, guys, I get this, right? I understand it. I feel you. I understand. I get it. You want to hang out with your buddies every now and again. It's cool. Let me just clarify, just so we're on the same page, your problem, okay? Here's your problem. You have a woman in your life who you don't deserve. And some of you are like, well, wait, you don't know me. That's true, and it doesn't matter. I don't need to know you. Like, statistically speaking, odds are really great that you don't deserve her. You have outkicked your coverage, and I'm proud of you. Way to go, all right? You don't deserve her. She's out of your league, okay? And your problem is that this woman, she loves you so much or cares about you so much that she wants to spend every waking moment with you. Your problem is that this woman who you don't deserve loves you and wants to hang out with you. That's your problem. Cry me a river, okay? So there's a little advice, okay? Next time you're feeling a little bit cramped in, it's like, oh man, I wish I had a little bit more space. Do yourself a favor, look deeply into her eyes and just say thank you, okay? That's just my little tip for you. Ladies, if I could have a word. When your guys want to go and hang out with their buddies, it doesn't mean that they don't love you or they don't care for you. In fact, it's actually kind of good for them. They're going to go hang out with their guys. It's just a different dynamic, all right? So just let them do it. It's okay. You'll be better off. They'll love you more. It's great. Okay. Aren't you glad you came this morning? I just solved like 80% of your relationship problems. You're welcome. Okay. Now, here's the deal. None of that all was setting this up, okay? Look, this is what David's saying right here. He is the luckiest guy in the world. The God of the universe, who is out of his league, who he does not deserve, loves and cares for him of all people. It's like he passed a note to God during recess and said, "Do you like me?" And God checked the yes box. And he's walking around on cloud 9. He's like, "Yes, that God loves me." And it doesn't take a genius to realize that you shouldn't take that for granted. If you have the God of the universe wanting to spend time with you and hang out with you, you don't act like that's no big thing. But again, it all depends on how highly we value God. Whether his love is going to make you uncomfortable, whether it's going to make you cringe, or whether it's going to make you dance around the room. Now, check it out. Here's part of the reason why David is so comfortable with the love of God. Here's why he feels secure. He doesn't feel burdened. He doesn't feel like God is like infringing on his space. No, here's part of the reason why. It's because he knows that God made him personally. In other words, God didn't just sort of like set the universe in motion and step back and just sort of watched in amazement as things sprung into existence. No, God was intimately involved in creating David. David didn't just spring up on the horizon and God was like, oh yeah, I kind of like that guy. No, no, God was right there in the midst of it, knitting and fashioning David into being. This is what he says in verse 13. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written life, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. David says, here's why I'm so comfortable with God's love. Because I'm not just like one random person who just sort of like sprung into existence. No, no, God was right there, intricately, intimately creating, fashioning me. He knows me better than I know myself. I cannot get away from him, and I don't want to. So most of you know that Carrie and I were expecting our third boy next month, so we're excited about that. And people keep asking us, are you ready for the third one? And our honest response is, it's the third one. He'll be fine. He's going to be just fine. They're basically indestructible. We've got some clothes and some diapers somewhere, and we'll find a place for him to sleep. It's not the same, right? It's just not the same from the first one to the third one. Now, I remember the first one, when Gabriel was born, and we were on top of it. It's like we're nesting, and we're getting everything ready. And you do that thing where you get online and you track every single week. Everybody who's got kids, you understand this. You track the pregnancy. These are the baby milestones. If you haven't had kids, don't worry about it. You'll figure this out later. And so you can go online. It's like, okay, week one, you don't even know you're pregnant, but you go back, all right? So week one, oh yeah, he's like this big, you know? And then week two, he's like this big. But it really was fascinating. Like, I had no idea about how babies develop and how they grow. And so it was fascinating to go back and to watch week by week by week how God is fashioning and creating this life inside my wife's stomach. Crazy idea. Crazy idea. And then you start to feel them move and you start to feel them alive inside. It's unreal. It is the miracle of life, and this is what David is saying here, that God himself is intimately involved in creating and knitting together not just David, but every single person who has ever lived and ever will live. He says that he knew you before you were even existed. He knew you. He knew every day you were going to have. There is no life that God doesn't create. No life that God doesn't create. God alone gives life, which means that conception is not just this biological event. It's not just a biological and chemical phenomenon. No, God is the one who is intimately involved in that. He's the one who provides the spark of life. He is the one who breathes life into existence. He breathes life into creation. And as far as science can go in terms of explaining to us how life begins, and it can tell us so much, and it's fascinating, and it's great that they've got all that information, it cannot tell us how it originally begins. It just keeps pushing back the question, how? Only God answers the why. God is the one who creates all life, which means, listen to me, which means that there are no unwanted babies. Every life is precious to God. There's no accidents. Every life is life that God himself has created, that he has intimately, intricately woven together, knitted together. Nobody snuck off and got pregnant and then surprised God with a baby. Look at this, God. Never happened. God is the one who creates life. There are no unwanted babies for God. There are no accidents for God. Every life is created by him. Therefore, every life, even life in the womb, is precious to God. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. And this is why abortion is such an evil on the face of this earth, because it is the destruction of the very life that God himself has created, made in his image, that he loves intensely. Like, I've seen grown men break down and cry when they wreck their cars or get a scratch on it. You think that God is a little bit unhappy, a little bit miffed when we take the life that he has created and snuff it out? Every life, even the ones not yet born, are precious to God. And please don't give me this line about how a baby still in the mother's womb is not a human being. Seriously, this is the best we can come up with? I mean, I've looked on the internet, I've looked all over, I've been trying to find legitimate arguments to explain why the baby growing inside my wife's stomach right now is not a human being. And I'm telling you, if you find a better one, please let me know. I want to hear it. Because the best that I've been able to come up with is this, that the baby who is not yet born is not human because, wait for it, they're not yet born. It's a question of viability. That's how the argument goes, that the baby can't survive outside the mother's womb, therefore it's not a human being. Newsflash. I know lots of people who can't survive outside their mother's womb. I've got a 3-year-old at home who cannot survive on his own, all right? I know a lot of you guys who cannot survive on your own. I'm not trying to be funny here. Listen, there are lots of elderly people in this world who cannot survive on their own. Does that mean they're not human beings? See, what we're talking about here is a spectrum. It's a matter of degree. Nobody survives on their own. All you're doing is moving around on the spectrum. My wife just took an online quiz about, like, are you a survivalist? It estimated she would survive 6 hours. Probably being generous. And she's proud of it. She's like, uh-huh, Starbucks. I love that about you. Right, so look, this is a spectrum. Somewhere on the degree, all of us fall on here somewhere. Nobody survives on there. If I took you and I put you on a desert island all by yourself without resources or supplies and just left you there, you're not going to make it long. Which means that basically all we're talking about here is a matter of location. So a baby who is inside the mother's womb, not human. Baby outside the mother's womb, human, which has about the same level of logic as saying that someone who lives in Pennsylvania is a human being and somebody who lives in Montana isn't. It is an arbitrary, subjective criteria invented to make us feel better about murdering children. And everybody knows it. Everybody knows it. There are no intelligent people who are still trying to hold that line, at least not with any integrity. And we're even hearing this from the other side now, those who are defending abortion, that they're realizing that they can't keep using that bogus argument anymore. It's not tenable. And so now they're starting to finally admit what we have known for a long time, that they know what abortion actually is. They know that it is murdering a human life. They just don't care. Damon Linker writes for an online publication called The Week, and this is what he says in defense of abortion. Okay, he's arguing for abortion rights. This is what he says. I'm convinced that abortion indisputably kills a human being, that human beings possess greater intrinsic worth than any other form of life, even when that form of life is an impressive and endangered animal. And that treating the body of a human victim of lethal violence as material to be harvested for its parts is a form of barbarism. Sounds like I'm pro-life, doesn't it? Well, I'm not. They know what abortion is. They just don't care. And this should terrify us. This should terrify us. Because what this means now is, because you can't argue biologically from science that baby is not a human being. So now we're finally starting to become honest about this, which is that the only argument left, and this is Damon Linker's argument, is that the life of the mother outweighs the life of the child inside of her. That her life matters more than the life inside of her, which takes us right up to a Nazi Germany level of crazy. As soon as we start saying that this life matters more than this life, we have left civilized society, and we are right in line, we are right alongside all the greatest human atrocities that this world has ever seen. Every genocide, ethnic cleansing, major human rights violation and abuse starts right there. That these lives matter more than these lives. And guess who gets to determine that these lives value more than these lives? The ones who are doing the killing. Now listen, I'm not saying that the life of the child outweighs the life of the mother. They're equal. So what I'm not suggesting that we just abandon the mom. Listen, what I'm saying here is that whatever the mom's issues are, okay, whatever her problems, whatever her struggles, that we have a responsibility to come alongside, to support, to encourage, to do everything that we can to give her the resources that she needs. We want to come alongside that mother, but we want to provide solutions that, call me crazy, don't involve killing a child. That's the key. Let me be really clear on this, okay? Abortion is taking a human life. It is a violation of the very heart and will of God. It is the anti-gospel. The gospel says, I will die for you. I will die for you. I'm going to put you ahead of me. I will die for your sake. And abortion says, you will die for me. Daniel Ritchie wrote an article, a blog for desiringgod.org just recently, and I love how he summarizes this. Abortion says unborn babies have value only as expendable commodities. Abortion says each baby is only a clump of tissue devoid of any purpose or life. Abortion says there's not a place for you in my plan right now. Abortion says disability limits a chance at any manner of a quality of life. The gospel says we have tremendous value as God's image bearers, Genesis 1:27. The gospel says each one of us is fearfully and wonderfully made, Psalm 139:14. The gospel says we have lovingly received the spirit of adoption as sons by whom we cry, Abba, Father, Romans 8:15. In other words, even when your parents don't want you, God does. The gospel says God's glory and grace shines in those with physical limitations or weaknesses, 2 Corinthians 12:9. I forgot to tell you that Daniel Ritchie was born without arms. Early in the pregnancy, doctors watched a sonogram and told his parents that he would be born with a severe disability, and his parents never hesitated in keeping him. And today, he is a pastor working with youth in North Carolina. He's been married for 9 years. He's got 2 kids. You cannot be a Christian. You cannot be a follower of Jesus and be pro-abortion, pro-choice, neutral, or indifferent. This is not a political issue. It's not a political issue. This is a gospel issue. This is a God issue. And don't let anyone try to convince you otherwise. And we have to be, we must be outraged. We cannot be silent. We have an obligation, we have a responsibility to our God that we stand up for those who do not have a voice, that we defend those who cannot defend themselves. And so let me give you a few practical ways that you can take up this fight against abortion. Give you just a few here. One is that there are online petitions right now that you can sign that are urging Congress to defund Planned Parenthood. I know that one vote has already failed, but we're trying to start some new ones and put pressure on them to reconsider. Planned Parenthood is the largest provider of abortions in our country. It is an evil and it is satanic. I didn't say the people were satanic, the organization of itself. Anything that murders children, this is the anti-gospel, is anti-God, and we need it to be closed, shut down. Next Saturday, there are going to be protests at Planned Parenthood offices all over this country. Next Saturday morning, 9 to 11, there's going to be one in Norristown. I think that's the closest one, but there's others in our area. And if you want to be part of that, you want more information about that, we will get that for you. We need to support crisis pregnancy centers like Baby's Breath right here in Phoenixville. We've supported them as a church, and we want to continue to do so. And if you want to be involved, you can give to them financially, support them that way. You can donate your time, but we need to come around those centers that are offering alternatives for these moms who are scared, oftentimes lied to, and they don't understand their real options or what abortion actually is. And so we need to come alongside them. This week, I'm going to put up resources and links to everything I just mentioned on Facebook. So if you need some help getting started, I want to provide that for you. But don't be silent. Don't be silent. Be gracious, be loving, be bold. And lastly, we need to pray. And this isn't an afterthought at all. Prayer is our most powerful weapon against spiritual forces. And make no mistake, this is a spiritual battle. There's a darkness that we have to pray against, and we need God to move in our country. This is the genocide of our day. In the Western world alone, we have over 1 million kids being aborted, murdered every year, and we need our God to put a stop to it. And we need to be praying for those innocent lives. We need to be praying for the moms who are confused, lost, lied to, deceived, that God would open their eyes and that they would turn around and walk out of those places. And we need to be praying for those doctors and nurses who are performing the abortions, that God would break their hearts and bring them to repentance. Because check this out, every life is precious, even theirs. They are fearfully and wonderfully made. Psalm 139 applies to them, and so we need to be praying for them, that God would change their hearts. And I'm not so naive to believe that there's no one in here who has not been profoundly impacted by abortion as well. And so if you're one of those people, maybe even you have encouraged someone to have an abortion previously, or you've had an abortion, I want to speak grace to you. I want to speak grace to you that abortion is not the unforgivable sin. God's grace always wins. It has never been bested, not once. There is always forgiveness. There is always mercy. There is always grace. You can't out-sin God's grace. None of us can. None of us can. And see, that's why David is so in awe of God's love. That's why David is so in awe of God's love, because he knows he needs grace, just like the rest of us. There's no innocent people in here. David certainly wasn't innocent. I mean, read his life, read some of the Psalms. He is a murderer, an adulterer. He's violent, cruel, and childish all the time. And he knew it. He knew that he was desperately in need of God's grace, and that's why he is in awe that the God of the universe who creates him, who is holy and perfect and just, would love him. That's why he prays to God, search me, know me, God. I don't want less of your love. I want more of your love. That you would love somebody like me, know my thoughts, know my words, know me better than I know myself, God. Because I don't deserve it. So give me more. Give me more. Look at how he closes the psalm here, verse 21. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. In other words, God, I want to think the way you think. Whatever you hate, I want to hate. Whatever you love, I want to love. I want to think your thoughts. Keep going. Verse 23. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. For David, God has become the center of his universe. He's completely wrapped his life up with God. All of his life revolves around God. God, I want you to know me. I want you to know me better than I know myself, and then I want you to change me. You are my centerpiece, God. I want everything in my life to revolve around and to complement who you are. It's not about me, it's about you, God. See, check this out. God is not an accessory. He's not an accessory that you pick up and you put down. You don't pick him up on your way to church and then drop him back off afterwards. He's not a handbag. He's not a purse. He's not a pair of sunglasses or a nice belt that complement your outfit. He's not an app for your iPhone. He's the operating system. He's not part of your world. He is your world. He's not part of your life. He is your life. And until we value him like that, until we see him like that, until we are amazed and in awe and just our breath is taken away by his beauty, his creativity, his justice, his goodness, his grace towards us that we do not deserve, we will not care about his love. Until we are in awe of God like that, then we will take his love for granted. We just won't care. We'll treat his love the way we treat the attention of the creepy guy in the supermarket. It's unwanted, it's uncomfortable, and we cringe. If we think little of God, we will think little of his love. But when we see God, as David sees him in his beauty, in his majesty, in his holiness, his perfection, and his goodness and his grace towards us, his love will make us dance. See, sin and Satan and death got together and they said, God, do you really love them? Do you really love them? I mean, all those little people that you so intricately wove together and you put them all together. I mean, there are so many of them. Do you really love each and every one of them? You and you and you and you. Every single one of them. Do you really love them? Would you die for them? And God checked the yes box without hesitation. And when that sinks into your soul and it grips your heart like it won't let go, it will make you dance. Like you're the luckiest person in the world because you are. The God of the universe who doesn't need you. He's not like, oh man, I hope they love me. No, the God of the universe who does not need you and yet he loves you. He adores you. And it doesn't take a genius to realize we shouldn't take that for granted.